This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Easy one, because I'm using a concept that we've developed several times in the past to understand a phenomenon which is occurring today, but which is not a new phenomenon, but it's somewhat more aggravated today, which is the trend, the interest, which is shown both in Jewish and non-Jewish circles, both in religious and non-religious circles, in the mystical and the mysterious. And it expresses itself in certain areas which are disturbing and in certain areas which aren't so disturbing. You might have seen an article, I think it was in today's paper, about the satanic cults that are developing. Now, that's very difficult for us to understand. What does that mean? How does a person get involved in a satanic cult? But these are very serious, and they do all sorts of weird things and very dangerous things. And that's one of many, many such groups. What's disturbing is that the people who participate in these groups are not cuckoos. They're ordinary people. They're ordinary, intelligent, very sane people. I think I told you about an experience I had in California some years ago, where a particular person was doing research on the Hare Krishna group, and his research was so devastating that the Hare Krishna group threatened to sue him. And he'd exposed, if I remember correctly, murders and things for which they were responsible. And they said, "We know we will lose the case, but you'll be wiped out before we lose it, because we're going to sue you in every state of the United States, and you'll have to defend yourself in 50 states. So he put away the material and he left it. And he described to me what went on, and I couldn't believe it. The main thing that I couldn't believe about it was, or shall I say, two aspects of it that I couldn't believe was, number one, how irrational it was, and number two, that the type of people who were involved were the most rational type of people you could imagine. So he said, "Do you really not believe me?" I said, "No, I just can't believe you. Please excuse me. I know you're an honest fellow, but I just can't believe you. This much I can't believe. That's asking too much of anybody's credibility." He said it was about midnight at that time that we were talking. He said, "What are you doing for the rest of the night?" I said, "Well, it's midnight already. There's not much of the night left." He says, "I'll tell you what. Sleep over at my house tonight, and I'll wake you up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we'll go and see. I'll show you what happens." I said, "You're on." So I went to bed, and a few hours later he woke me up, and we drove through the city of Los Angeles, and we came to one of these Hare Krishna temples, and we stood outside for about 45 minutes, during which time he pointed out to me the people who were filing in, but hundreds and hundreds of people were filing in, with children on their backs, husbands, wives, families, 4 o'clock in the morning. And he says to me, "This is regular, this is not once, it's not no special occasion, this is their regular routine." That fellow there is one of the senior attorneys in Los Angeles. That one there is a leading businessman. There's a judge. That one. And so he reeled off who these people were. That one's Jewish. That one's not Jewish. That's a professor of mathematics. Highly rational and sane people. And then he exposed me to some of what actually takes place there. Totally irrational. Totally irrational. And at the end of the experience, when I really couldn't, I just couldn't fathom what had actually happened to me, he said, "One of the great authorities is here from India. He's a Jew. And he's giving a lecture. Let's sit in a little bit. Let's hear how he explains it." He's an intelligent person, a highly intelligent university graduate, I think an ex-professor, Jewish fellow, who became a Hare Krishna. And he's got this body of highly intelligent people sitting around him. And he's going to give them a lecture. Let's hear. How does he explain it all? And basically what he said to them was, "It's true," he said, "that if you go to the Ganges River in India and you look at it, it will look murky and dirty to you. But when I look at it, it looks pure and clean. And you must understand that there, the reason it looks murky and dirty to you is because of the dirt in your eyes. Whereas my eyes are clean and I see things differently." Once you've established that, then you can say whatever you want. And so the lecture went on, and then everything becomes okay. Whatever you say, you have the authority to say. And the people lapped it up, and they enjoyed it. And that was the first time that I started becoming very concerned about this trend. I've mentioned to you also, and as I say, it's an easy issue because I'm going over things that I've said before. also on one of those trips, where it was the time that Reverend Moon was doing well in America, and you remember Reverend Moon was a Korean who couldn't speak a word of English, but he became a multi-millionaire with all his followers. He used to get hundreds of thousands of attendees at his rallies. And I once asked a Moonie whether he understood Korean, and he said, no. I said, do you understand when Reverend Moon speaks? He said, yes. I said, what language is he speaking? He says, in Korean. I said, but I just asked you whether you understand Korean. He says, you don't understand. When Reverend Moon speaks, you don't have to understand the words. They're so holy, they penetrate directly into your intellect. Okay, fine. And then on that same trip, I went from America to Korea. I mentioned to you once, and they told me that Billy Graham had just been there, and that there were 1 million people came to listen to him. And I said to the taxi driver who told me this, were you there? He said, yes. I said, he could hardly speak English, hardly communicating in very, very broken English. I said, could you understand Billy Graham? He said, no, he couldn't understand. I said, of the 1 million people, how many could understand? He said, he doesn't think anybody. So I said, what were they there for? He said, to listen to Billy Graham. Couldn't understand. I said, did you enjoy it? Ah, he said, it was wonderful. What an experience. And then I realized that Billy Graham could never get 1 million people in America, and Reverend Moon would never get 1 million in Korea. And that the reason that they were both so successful is because they were offering something that these people were deprived of. And that's a sense of mystery, of mystique, of exaltedness, of high things which one doesn't quite, all this gobbledygook that one doesn't quite come to terms with. And then I realized that this is something which is taking place in our own circles as well. But very often you'll hear somebody say, I listened to a shiur, it was wonderful, what was done? It was a Kabbalah. Huh? Did you understand it? Well, no, I didn't understand it exactly, it was a wonderful shiur. Okay, and is that any different to the Muni? Is that answer any different to the Muni? But I hear that answer often. Very often I hear it. Here, in this town, overseas, people will say, I went to a shiur. Wonderful. What was so wonderful? What did they say? It was high and with these difficult things, difficult. I can't tell you exactly. No, he talked about the spheres and this and Mishtalshulus and Tzimtzum. It was wonderful, wonderful. It's like the Muni, no different. Or like the Koreans going to Billy Graham and the Americans going to it's the same thing. A certain thrill at hearing things that one can't understand. And this goes back a long time. This, in fact, in a sense, and I mean this now in a very different sense, but still it's perhaps the beginning of the trend and why the Vilna Gaon was so worried about it, is something that the Baal Shem Tov perceived as a need when he started popularizing Kabbalah in the beginning of the 18th century. That he realized there was a need for that. And it's certainly something which brought about the rise of the Musar movement 100 years later. Let's explain, let's try and analyze it and understand it a little bit more carefully. We notice in the experience of Matan Torah, of the giving of the Torah, that the whole experience was enormously powerful. And at the end of the description of the giving of the Torah, after we've been told that the mountain of Sinai was all smoky and the Hashem came down on it in a fire, and there was the sound of the shofar going a little stronger and stronger, Moshe was speaking and Hashem answered him with a voice that one could hear and so on. Eventually it says, V'chol ha'om ro'im, and all the people saw, es ha'koilos ves ha'lapidim, the sounds, the voices, and the torches. So we see audio, we see visual. There was sound, and there was torches. Ve'es kol ha'shefer, ve'es ha'har oshem. And there was the sound of the shofar, and there was the smoky mountain. Audio and visual. Vayar ha'om vayanu, and the people saw, and they trembled, vayamdu me'rochok, and they stood from far. There was a violently imposing scene that embodied both audio and visual. And the concept that I referred to in the beginning, that I said that we've developed on several other occasions to explain all sorts of ideas, and the one that I want to use to explain here, is the relationship between the audio and the visual, and the synthesis of the two, which is what took place at Har Sinai. The visual is a wonderful sense because it gives us extreme clarity. We can see with definition. We can see with precision. And we can see far. The audio is also a wonderful sense. It doesn't give the same precision, it doesn't give the same clarity, and one can't hear from the same distance. One has to be closer to hear. Sometimes one hears incorrectly. It's more easy to hear incorrectly than it is to see incorrectly. As I've said to you, that if there are 100 people listening to a shiur, even if it's of somebody who speaks more clearly than I do and explains concepts better than I do, you will still find that there will be 100 different versions as to what was said. But if you ask the 100 people who gave the shiur, and that's unanimous. Everybody saw who gave it. That was no. So you see, the visual is no. Everybody sees the same. Comes to the audio, everybody hears different. So the audio doesn't have that same objective clarity. But it has other things. The audio has depth. The visual, you can only see the surface. The audio, you can hear from beneath the surface too. Firstly, you can hear from behind. You can hear what goes on inside, even if you can't see. And secondly, when you hear a sound, that sound is created by the entire object. If you knock on a piece of wood, that sound is unique to that piece of wood. If you knock on another piece of wood, if your ear is sensitive, it will sound a little different. Depending on the size of the wood and the texture of the wood and the density of the wood, all sorts of things. So by the careful analysis of the sound, you can actually tell what it is that you're hearing. So the sound actually gives you information from deep within the object. When you play a musical instrument, it's not just the surface that is producing that. The whole instrument is resonating. Sound requires resonance, and the richer the sound, the more resonance there is. It comes from every molecule of the object, produces the sensation of sound. There's no molecule of the object which is not occupied in the production of that sensation of sound. Not so vision. The only molecules that are involved in the image of vision is the superficial molecules, the surface. And with vision alone, you in fact don't know if there's anything beneath the surface. You have to knock to see if it's hollow or solid. Then you can hear whether it's hollow or solid. You need the two. The visual gives superficial clarity, and the audio gives deep understanding. Now, it's interesting in many areas that you can have two concepts that interfere with one another. And you actually have to minimize the one in order to increase the other. Like filling a glass with water and getting rid of the air. You can't have both. The more water you put in, the less air. If you pump air into the glass, the water will go out. There's a beautiful image that's given in the 38th Perek of Eev, which refers back to the Maisa Bereshis, of the whole creation of the dry land, which from the Chumash is very difficult to perceive, but the way the Malbim explains that passage of Eev, it's very beautiful, because Eev talks about the birth of dry land. He gives the image of dry land being born out of the womb. And the Malbim explains that on the second day of creation, you remember, Hashem talks about the fact, the Torah talks about the fact that there was water, that the sky, the Rakia was created firstly. What does Rakia mean? So we'll translate Rakia as atmosphere. Atmosphere was created. And the Ribbono Shel Olam separated from the water that was below the atmosphere, between the water below the atmosphere, and the water within the atmosphere. Which the Malbim learns that on that second day of creation, Hashem created evaporation. And he divided water into its liquid form and into its gaseous form. So the sea first was a bulk of liquid, which covered the whole globe, and the whole globe was this muddy, watery surface. Then Hashem on the second day created evaporation, and part of the sea was then drawn up into the atmosphere in the form of water vapor, and that contracted the remaining liquid to the point where land started to become visible. So the land was born out of that contraction of the ocean. Beautiful image. And there we see also that sometimes you need to contract one body in order to make place for another body. You can't have them both together. We have it in another area as well. We say every morning, Yetzer Oyur Uvevei Choshech. Hashem formed light and created darkness. What does it mean he created darkness? Darkness is the absence of light. You don't create darkness, you take away the light, and then you've got darkness. But one has to realize that sometimes when you take one thing away, you are forming a new thing. Darkness is not just the absence of light. It doesn't just create an emptiness. The absence of light is a completely new mitzvah. It creates something new. What does it create? Darkness is the absence of light, which means the absence of the ability to use the visual. That's what darkness is. Darkness doesn't mean darkness like it is dark in Johannesburg. It never really gets dark in Johannesburg. One doesn't know what darkness is unless you go out of town into the bush, and there you turn off all the lights and you go outside, and if there's no moon, then you understand what darkness is. Then you see what darkness is. Cheshech is where you can't use the visual, where you have to rely on the audio, except on your sense of feel as well, for your immediate environment. But if you want to move slightly beyond your immediate environment, you have nothing to rely on other than the audio sense. You've got to listen, you've got to hear. And we find, in fact, that at night, people say sound carries better at night. What does it mean, sound carries better at night? So in one sense, it probably means there's less going on, there's less distraction. So when there is a sound, you hear it more clearly. But I think sound carrying better at night is something else too. I think it's the subjective sense. One is far more alert to sound at night than one is during the daytime. Just as a blind person becomes far more alert with his other senses, and a deaf person becomes far more alert with his visual sense, so you find when you block off one sense, the others become sharp. Nighttime is a time when our sense of hearing is particularly sharp, and we're very dependent on it. That's the Beirei Cheshech. By removing light, the Ribbono Shel Olam is emphasizing the audio. He's de-emphasizing the visual and emphasizing the audio. That's what we mean. Beirei Cheshech, that's a new creation. That's a Bria. Nighttime is a completely different atmosphere to daytime. Nighttime is a scary, spooky time. Nighttime is a dramatic time. Nighttime is a mysterious time. Nighttime is a romantic time. It enables all sorts of things to take place which don't take place so easily in the daytime. Why? When vision is strong, there's not much place for mystery. When vision is strong, there's not much place for romance, because there's clarity. And romance and mystery thrives on obscurity. If things aren't very clear, then there is a place for mystery, then there is a place for romance, then there is a place for these subtle things which people crave for and which people need. And that's why, by the way, in the laws of marriage, tzniyus plays such an important part. One has to realize that calling a spade can destroy the romance. And that's not a non-Jewish idea, that's a Jewish idea. Sometimes things need to be a little bit obscure. Sometimes these things need to be, the visual needs to be de-emphasized in order to allow the emphasis of non-visual sensations. And non-visual sensations occupy the human being far more than visual sensations. A visual sensation, there's very little I have to do. It all comes from outside me. There is absolute clarity outside me. I just have to be exposed to it. I'm totally passive, and I see it all. The audio is not so. At night time, when the Ribbono Shel Olam removes our visual and leaves us to rely on our audio, then one finds imagination starts coming in. Then you start hearing things that you don't hear during the daytime. You start interpreting the things that you hear in a different way to the way you would interpret it in the daytime. Things are different. You're using your own imagination. This difference between the subjective involvement in the visual and the audio senses apply in many, many areas. I've given you the example once of what theatre used to be in Elizabethan times, in Shakespearean times. No props on the stage, no dramatic sets. The visual was very much de-emphasized, and that's why it is almost as pleasurable to read Shakespeare as it is to watch Shakespeare. People read, there are not many plays that people read. Do they read? You don't read plays. Why not? It's all there. Because you need the visual. With Shakespeare, you actually don't need the visual. In fact, if you see a Shakespearean play the way Shakespeare used to have it played out, the visual doesn't add much more. It's merely the audio, in fact. The sound you get, it's said aloud. And that's why, for example, you see that it's very popular among educated people to have Shakespeare on recordings. And you have good recordings, a record of Shakespeare, a tape recording of Shakespeare. People listen to it. And it's almost as good as going to the play. But you don't hear recordings of I don't know what other plays or movies that can imagine saying to somebody, "No, I'm busy tonight. What are you doing? I'm listening to a record. What record are you listening to?" Some movie out of the time. You're listening to, or you're going to watch? No, I'm not going to watch, I'm listening to. You listen to Shakespeare? You can listen to Walt Disney also? How can you listen to Walt Disney? Walt Disney you have to see. Hollywood is visual. Shakespeare was audio. And theatre, the way it used to be, occupied the subject far more. He had to think, he had to imagine, he became involved. The more the emphasis is placed on the visual, the less involvement is required from the human being. So when one sees, when one is exposed to a visual dramatic impact, so a Hollywood production, then you can sit back, you don't have to do anything. So how do you keep the attention? There has to be enormous suspense, there has to be a lot of action. That's the only way that you can keep the interest. It's interesting also that different cultures operate differently, and if you see the American culture emphasizes the visual. They've become untrained in listening, untrained in reading. The audio has been de-emphasized. The impact of television has been so enormous that they don't know how to listen properly anymore. It's all visual. And visual imagery has to be used. You remember that President Reagan was very effective in communicating. And if you watched him talk, most South Africans couldn't understand why he was so effective. What was so effective? Yeah, nice old man talking nicely. But he wasn't a charismatic, dynamic speaker that held you spellbound. Not at all. Very ordinary man who stood there with a nice smile on his face and said nice things. What was the effectiveness of it? The effectiveness of it, we didn't see that much of it here, but he used it a lot in the United States. He used to give visual impact. When he talked about inflation, he took a pile of dollar notes and he showed how high it used to be and how high it is now. On television, he used to show everything visually. And that people understood. That had tremendous impact. When you show somebody something, particularly somebody who doesn't know how to listen, who only knows how to look. And when he sees it, it becomes very real. And President Reagan knew how to use the visual. He was trained in Hollywood. He knew how to use the visual to communicate. Exactly the opposite, by the way, of the president that they had just before him, the funny man, remember. He was an intellectual. He was a very clever man. But he couldn't communicate. Certainly not with Americans, because he didn't have the visual. He would communicate intellectually, and Americans found it difficult to listen intellectually, to listen audially. Europe is different a little bit. Europe is a culture which is used to reading, a culture which is used to listening, a culture which is not so involved in the drama of visual impact. And so, as I've mentioned once before, one finds even in the art forms that are produced from the civilized European countries, one finds the emphasis is far more on the audio than on the visual. This subjective involvement question becomes serious also in that the form of entertainment becomes sometimes very harmful and very dangerous, as we've often discussed. It's very important if you want to get put off going to movies, and it's a good thing to get put off going to generally. One of the ways to do it is to buy a seat in the front row and to spend the time looking back and watch the faces of the people. And you'll see a room full of intelligent people looking like zombies. And you realize and you say to yourself, but forget what's on the screen. If I said to you, would you like to spend an hour like that? Look at those people there. Would you like to be like them for an hour? You would never want to. Dull, dead, hardly moving, unless there's something very dramatic on the screen. Then you'll see them getting a little bit interested. If there's something very funny, you'll see them laugh, you'll see some kind of response. But for 80% of the running of the movie, you'll see this dull, expressionless, glazed look on their faces. And the same when people are watching television. Doesn't matter whether they're watching a good piece of television, or a poor piece, a documentary, or the news as well. Watch people's faces, watch children. And you'll see this dull look, uninvolved. But they're not really involved, they are involved, yes, but they're being involved by visual impact. It's not being drawn out of them, it's being imposed upon them. And when something is being imposed on you, you are inactive. And no matter how interesting it might be because of the dramatic impact, the fact is you're not operating, you're not thinking, you're not living at that time, you're dulled, you're desensitized during that time. And so however good the program is, if it's using visual mechanisms primarily and not incorporating the audio, and I must emphasize, as I always do when we talk about these subjects, that by audio I'm not talking about just the sense of hearing, and visual just the sense of sight. By visual I'm talking about dramatic impact, and by audio I'm talking about the intellect, the thinking, the feeling, the imagination, everything that goes into the process of listening. Concentration. You don't have to concentrate for the visual. If it's very dramatic, if it's very charismatic, if it's very powerful, you don't need to concentrate. You can't help but concentrate. To concentrate when you can't help but concentrate is not called concentration. That's passive. And people think they're concentrating and they say, I sat riveted for 2 hours. That's not concentration. That's total passivity. The person says, you know, 2 hours was hard to concentrate, but I managed. That's concentration. I had to follow the argument, I had to think it through, I had to reason it through. That's concentration. And so one finds that quite apart from the negative impact of the contents of television programs and movies, and there's a lot of negativity in the content, because to keep people interested it's got to shock people. And people aren't shocked anymore by murders, and they're not shocked anymore by... So it's got to become more and more outrageous to keep people attentive. Since they're not using their audio ability, and so the language deteriorates, and the storyline deteriorates, and the action deteriorates, and it becomes coarse, and it becomes negative, and it becomes corrupt, and it becomes destructive. But quite apart from that, even if it's a good one, and a clean one, you've got the person sitting for that period of time totally passive. And it might be more productive very often to just go to your GP and ask him to give you an injection of the high dose of Valium, and let him just knock you out for a couple of hours instead. At least that way you'll have the rest. Because it's total passivity. There's nothing else involved. And you don't think that you're passive because you're being exposed to action and it feels exciting. But look at the faces of the people around you and you'll see it is passive. No matter how exciting what's happening on the screen is, nothing is happening in the people. It's all on the screen. Nothing's happening inside the person. And if nothing's happening inside the person, it's passive. And goes to an art gallery and looks at a work of art. That's not dramatic impact. But you look at the faces of people in art galleries, it's different. The person's looking at a picture, you would think he's looking at a stationary picture, standing in front of one picture for 10 or 15 minutes, you would expect his face to be inactive, you'd expect him to stand there boring and passive, but it isn't. Look at the faces of people in art galleries. There's aliveness in their faces, there's alertness, their eyes are moving, there's expressiveness. You see that it's a living person. Because he has to use his own resources to find meaning in what he's looking at. It's not purely visual. There's audio as well there. He's got to hear the painting, not just see it. There's nothing much to look at. But when you hear it, when it begins to talk to you, but for that you're using the audio. The audio is subjective. The visual is objective. And so we find that the Ribbono Shel Olam has created times where we can use our eyesight, daytime, clarity, times in the night time where there's less objective clarity. He has created the audio and he has created the visual. What we find happening in the type of lifestyles that are being led today is that not only in forms of entertainment but in all forms of life there is a superficiality and a sense of routine and repetitiveness which can be compared to the visual type of living rather than the audio type of living. There are countless examples. To me, one of the most painful things that I could do is occasionally if I go with my wife to shop, one shouldn't, not because I go with her, but the emphasis is going to shop, the emphasis is not going with my wife to shop, going with my wife to shop, at these big supermarket stores, massive places. And it's painful because one comes out of it feeling totally empty. What have you done? You've gone through the shopping list, you've spent money, and you're going to have to do it again next week. Was there any excitement? No. Was there any interest? No. What was it? Nothing. Just pushing this heavy trolley around, standing in a queue, coming to a cashier, taking your things, going out. But the full impact of how negative an experience that is hit me when we had these few days off, the reason for which there wasn't a Matzah Shabbos shiur last week. And as I was taking our family through to the place that we were staying at, we passed through a tiny little village, and two bottle stores, one grocery, one of everything. And I said, this is the last shopping center you're going to see now. If you need it, she says, yeah, well, then we must stop and we must get something. And we go in, and it's a little store, a little greengrocer, two Portuguese people, a husband and a wife. She sits at the one till, he sits at the other till. And we bought what we had to buy. And we got back into the car. I said, didn't you enjoy that? And my wife said, yes, but it could never happen in Johannesburg. Now, what had happened? What was different? What had happened was that when you were standing and paying for your goods were being cashed up, you had a few words with the cashier. Where do you come from? And she told us her story. She comes from the island of Madeira, and we talked about Madeira a little bit, and where her husband comes from, and how long they've been in this country, and how they like it, and the child that she's just had, and whether the child looks like him or looks like her. And it didn't take any longer, because it was while she was cashing up. And you walked out with a feeling not of having been drained, of having had an experience which is empty, which is negative, which is... What's the difference? Just had some human contact. There was some give and take. There was audio, not only visual. This wasn't just an area of routine. This was interpersonal relationship. And we're funny because we try to save money wherever we can. So what do? We shop at these big shopping supermarkets. Not that I'm knocking them. I'm sure they do wonderful work and save people a lot of money. And then we get bored. So the money we save at the supermarkets, we spend on going to the movies to try and get the adrenaline going a little bit. And then the movies don't do that at all, because at the end of it, you haven't been audially involved, you feel still more bored than you were before, and you go back the next day to your routine job, where you're still more bored, and by that time it's necessary to go to the shops again, and now you've spent all your money on going to the movies, so you can't afford to go to a smaller shop, you've got to go back to the cheapest shop, which are these big warehouse kind of shops, and so you do to save the money, and spend the money that you saved, and trying to cheer yourself up from the misery caused by saving the money. And so it goes. Whereas if people would realize that you don't need entertainment if you lived with entertainment. If instead of going to the supermarket, you went to the family store, I don't know if they have them anymore. Chemists we still have, thank God. I don't know whether they still have other family little stores where you can go and you can have a word when you buy, and they might even deliver for you, and he might even tell you that the apples aren't so good today, why don't you wait till tomorrow, he's getting some fresh ones. It makes you feel good, he cares about you. And there's a little bit of talk backwards and forth, so it's going to cost you more. I'm not saying that al pi halacha you've got to pay more for your gingers. I'm just talking. I'm just thinking out that we live in a strange way and we do funny things. But the more that it's going to cost you is less than the cost of entertainment. And the entertainment would have been far more healthy. You'll feel far more satisfied after that. You go into the family chemist and you have a talk and a schmooze, and your child's got a cough and your other child's got a cold, and so and so's also got a cough, and you hear a bit of the gossip, and you hear what's going on in the town, and you come out feeling good. You don't come out feeling drained. So the chemists tell me that it's not true that it costs any more at their place than at the big places. Be that as it may, and if it does cost a bit more, so what? I'm not plugging Joe Kern's chemist. It's just the way we operate. There are opportunities to find human contact and to find richness and to find relationships in our day-to-day living which we studiously avoid to save a bit of money, which we then have to spend on entertainment to substitute for the lack of interest that we're running our lives with. We're stripping our lives of all human content to try and streamline it and make it more efficient, more competent, more economic. And look what we lose in the process. The whole business ethics thing which I'm busy with at the moment is not so much business ethics. I've come to a different view. And that is that people are ethical. People would like to do ethical things. But it's not economic to do ethical things always. And that's the problem. So what are you going to do? You can't make it economical to be ethical. But the fact is, it's the same kind of concept. People need more spirituality in their day-to-day activities. They need to feel that they're real human beings. The commercial environment, the business environment, has been stripped of human values because it's been stripped of human relationships. And if you're not dealing with real people, then things don't mean the same. Computer fraud is much easier than stealing real money. A person who doesn't mind organizing a computer fraud of $1 million would never put his hand into somebody else's till and take out $1. Why not? Audio and visual. It's the difference. The one is purely concepts. You're just dealing. It's become so stripped of any kind of human content that you don't realize that the $1 million that you're manipulating on the computers is actually real money that you're taking away from somebody. You never see the somebody. You never hear from the somebody. It's money's on it's figures on a screen. That's all. To put money, to put your hands into somebody's till, that you would never do. Never do. And that's why you can find people who are moral and ethical in their day-to-day lives, and in their business environments don't see the need to be, because it's not real. We've made life so unreal, we've extracted from it all the healthy things, all the good things, all the human things, all the sensitive things. And we've left it so ethereal and so theoretical and so fine that we're dealing with concepts, we're not dealing with people. And when one's dealing with concepts, there isn't such a thing really as ethics and values. Paul Johnson said recently at a talk on business ethics, the discussion is capitalism ethical or isn't it ethical? At the end of the day, he said it's neutral. It's not ethical. It's not ethical. Capitalism, he said, is neutral. But capitalists need to become ethical. There's a difference. If one sees everything as capitalism, as economics, as commerce, as theoretical concepts, there's no need for a value system, because you're dealing with objects, you're not dealing with people. When we will re-establish personal contact in business and in commerce, when people will realize that these are real human beings dealing with one another, that that's what business is, buying and selling, whether you're using computers and you're doing it across the globe and telephones and modems and all sorts of fancy forms of communication, at the end of the day, it's two real human beings with families, with problems, with sorrows, with ambitions, with emotions, with cravings, two real human beings who are dealing with one another, with fears, with insecurities. Then one can start to communicate. And then communication becomes meaningful, and then value systems need to be introduced or reintroduced into the forms of communication. I'm just giving you examples of our day-to-day life that has been stripped of all the things that we really crave for, and we then have to find artificial ways of getting it back. It's like the food industry, where we've taken all the good vitamins and things out of the foods through over-refining, and then they add them back again. And then you'll find them, here it's not even as bad as it is in the United States. You buy a bottle of milk in the United States, it's got a list of ingredients a mile long of all the additives they've put in. Why do they have to put the additives in? Because they took them out. They charge you for taking it out, they charge you again for putting it back in. Why take it out? Why put it in? Just leave it alone. But we do that with life as well. We take out all the good things, we siphon it all off, all the cream we take off to make it more efficient. And then we feel drained, so we put it back in again in artificial forms. And we're doing this all the time. It's absolutely sick. But we're doing it in religion as well. We're doing it in Torah as well. Where we, because of whatever reasons, it might be part of the same disease, part of the same life form, that we strip meaning out of our religious practices. And that too becomes technical routines that we go through. And we don't realize at the end of the day, Torah is relationships. It's relationships between ourselves and the Ribono Shel Olam. It's relationships between ourselves and one another, our wives and our families and our friends. It's relationships between ourselves and our objective environment and our physical material environment. That's what it is. And when one sees it's a value system. Is that the Shabbos clock? Is that the Shabbos clock, isn't it? Now we can get on to the mystical part. That was well timed.
Now we can get the ordinary. Now we can listen.
Thanks. Well, yeah, you could imagine for those few moments, imagine giving the shiur in the dark with a few candles on and so on. It could be very effective. And so we have also in the area of Torah and mitzvahs, we have also stripped it of its meaning. We've stripped it of being a system of values, of being interrelationships between ourselves and the various things around us. And we need, therefore, to artificially reintroduce the adrenaline into Yiddishkeit, just as we've done in all the other areas of our lives. We even do it in our learning, where the learning becomes very technical. You say, what did you learn today? I learned to read and translate. Good. And how much did you read and translate? This amount or that amount. Fine. It's important to read and translate. One has to know how to read and translate. And so it goes on. What did you learn today? I learned 25 pages of Gemara. And I can recite it to you off by heart. Fantastic, wonderful. But that doesn't do anything inside you. That's visual information. That's information management. That's not understanding. That's not analysis. That's not using the subject. A certain rabbi showed me an examination that he had subjected his shiur to on a particular masechta that they'd finished. And he felt very proud that they could answer those questions. And indeed it was an achievement. Questions like, how many times does Rabbi Yehuda appear in the masechta? How many times does such and such a word appear in the masechta? Forwards, backwards, this, that. It's very awesome to think that a group of people can actually master that amount of information, but that's all it is. It's information mastery. What's important is to understand concepts, to understand principles, to see that beneath the legal ideas and the ritualistic formalities, that each one of them is the embodiment of a godly principle of value, which is human, which is real, which needs to be absorbed and needs to be practiced. That's where the learning becomes challenging, and that's where it becomes extremely hard and very difficult. After one's gone through the technical part, one can read and one can translate, one's gone through the visual, then comes the audio. Then one has to hear what it's saying. Then it's got to become like the painting in the art gallery. It's got to speak to one. And that part of it is very personal. It's very difficult to be taught to do that, because if one is taught, then it becomes visual again. That's something one has to be taught to do oneself. For only when one is doing it oneself is it truly audio. But the result of not doing it is this impoverishment, this intellectual impoverishment that we're all suffering from. And I've spoken about it in various different forms over the last few months. The intellectual impoverishment, Jewish, non-Jewish, frum, non-frum, it doesn't make any difference. But even among ourselves, an intellectual impoverishment. Not that we're not involved in mental activity, we are. And as a group of people here, we're probably more involved in mental activity than 99% of the other people around us. We are learning and we are applying our minds, but there's a difference between mental activity and true intellectual activity. And by intellectual, I don't mean it in the secular sense, I mean it in the Torah sense. Intellectual, I mean where it is not only intellectually creative in the mental sense, but intellectually creative also in the spiritual sense, in the human sense, where there is a synthesis of science and art, where in everything that one understands, one is understanding it with scientific accuracy and artistic beauty. And the two are becoming synthesized together, absorbing every part of the personality in the process of learning and the process of understanding. And if we don't do that, then it doesn't matter how much we learn. It's like shopping in the big supermarkets. You can shop as much as you want, it's still an empty experience. And you can do it 10 times a day and 20 times a day, it's still an empty, because the more you do an empty thing, the more empty you feel. And so you can go in the vicious circle of trying to then substitute it with all sorts of other activities, but any routine remains and is very empty. In this quiet little place that we went a week ago, something happened that shouldn't have happened, but it was interesting. People in a cottage nearby us, and this is quiet, in the middle of the bush, just a few little houses, nothing for miles around. People on Motzei Shabbos, this time last, maybe it was a punishment for me for not being here. The people who hired on Motzei Shabbos the house next door us with a few youngsters who came to celebrate the 21st birthday, and they brought the disco equipment and they turned the volume on full, and they were having a good time. And so I went in to see them and schmooze with them a little bit, which was an interesting experience all on its own, and we came to some kind of understanding of our mutual needs. But the interesting thing was, one of my younger children came to me very disturbed the next morning, and she said, "How can people listen to music for so long?" So I said, "Was that music? Is that the kind of music you hear me listening to?" She said, No, I mean that kind of music." I said, "What was wrong with that kind of music?" She said, "It was the same theme being played over and over and over and over again. It's like Bantu music. Disco music and African music is very much the same. One little theme over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. It's unbelievable." And it's only a couple of days ago, I think, that Mrs. Isaacson mentioned to me that that's a reflection of our lifestyle. Doing the same things over and over and over again. There's not a change in harmony. There's not a change in instrumentation. There's not a change in key. Well, classical music is also the same themes being reintroduced over and over again. But the brilliance of it is that the composer introduces it over and over again in such a way that you don't even realize it's the same theme. Only when you sit and study it do you realize this is the same theme coming back and back. What's he done? He's taken one theme and he's dressed it up with such richness. Different keys, different instruments, different forms, different notes. The richness is built up. and you take popular music, and it's the same theme with no attempt to introduce richness in its repetition, but merely to repeat it over and over and over again. And that's our lifestyle. Look at one day after another, it's the same theme over and over and over again. So you'll say to me, but that is life. The fact is, you get up every morning and you have shakris and you have breakfast and you go to work and you come home and you go to mincha maariv and you have a shiur and you go in for supper. That's the work. That's how our lives are. That's true. But our choice is now to make it pop music or to make it classical music. Are we going to take the themes which we redo every day and do each one a little different, play each one in a slightly different key with different instruments and different background instruments so as to lend richness to it? Or are we going to strip it of all the richness to make it economic and efficient and reduce it to its bare essentials and make it boring and routine? What are we going to do? That's our choice. But the fact that we tend, through the pressures of the kind of lives that we live, to keep it in its bare routine and to keep it like pop music rather than classical music means we need to substitute that with other forms of entertainment. And in each area we have these forms of entertainment. The frum area of that entertainment then becomes that area of mysticism. Because there one is able to become involved in something which is not routine, in something which is totally different, in something which doesn't make such rational sense. And you now begin to understand why the more rational a person is in his day-to-day activities, the more he becomes attracted to the irrational in the mystical. Because that's what he craves for, that's what he lacks in his day-to-day activities. If he shops at these big supermarkets instead of the little family stores, he craves interest, he craves something a little different, he craves interpersonal contact, he craves a bit of the spiritual. Where is he going to find spiritual? In his work, in driving to work. Watch people's faces in their motor cars driving to work and back. Look at the faces, see if they're alive or dead. It's frightening to see. And in this city, more than in other cities, it's a frightening experience. Just watch the faces of oncoming traffic, the drivers. Just look at them. It's frightening. And then you think to yourself, do I look the same way? The answer is yes, you do. That's exactly how you look also. And so we find that we don't get this interest, this spiritual impact, the human side, the value system. We don't get it, so we need it canned. We need to take it in concentrated forms and have it thrown at us so that we can get some breath of life, a little bit of something elevating, a little bit of something uplifting. And that's where we find it. And as I said, the Baal Shem Tov realized that in the early 18th century, that there had already been at that time in certain areas of Europe a drying out of religious routine. And it was through the introduction of Hasidus at that time that he introduced tried to reintroduce a certain spirituality back into the day-to-day lives of these people. There was a realization on the part of Rabbi Yisroel Salanter that the day-to-day routine of yeshiva studies had become void of the value system. And so he had to reintroduce the value system in an intense canned form. In the Musar movement, that there should be a time dedicated to intense Musar emphasis so that the human value system side, that the human side, the value system side, the spiritual side can be reintroduced into the routine of the yeshiva. And there was criticism of the Musar movement, and the reason for that criticism was just that. Don't extract the vitamins and then put them back artificially. Rather put the vitamins back into the general routine, not to have 1/2 hour for Musar. There needs to be Musar in all the learning, there needs to be Musar in all the shiurim, there needs to be Musar, there needs to be ethics, morality, spirituality, in everything that's taking place. And that fight was eventually won by the Musar movement because the facts were such, the pressures were such that it wasn't being handled in that way and it was necessary to can it separately. But the fear on the mystical side goes far more than that. It's not just a matter of canning. There's something else on the mystical side, and here we need to refer back to Matan Torah. V'chol ha'om, and all the nation, Reim es hakolos ves halapidim, saw the voices, they saw the audio and the visual. It doesn't say they heard the audio and the visual. And it doesn't say they saw the visual and heard the audio. They saw the visual and the audio. And Kabbalistically, what does that mean? That just as energy and matter can be transferred from one to the other, energy is not something which cannot become materialized. One can take energy and convert it into matter. So all forms of energy, including spiritual energy, can be materialized. And words, dibur, is a source of energy. Communication is a source of energy, and it can be materialized. It can become concrete, as we see, in fact, where words can be recorded. and can be preserved and can be repeated and thrown back and be preserved for hundreds of years, thousands of years. But it is possible to take sound and to turn sound also into little particles, so to say. And so too, when the Ribbono Shel Olam spoke, it wasn't just an experience of hearing his voice, but that voice was such a powerful form of energy, and the process of Matan Torah was in fact the materialization of God's will. That's what the Torah is. It's God's will, his innermost will, materialized, concretized into something you can touch, you can look at, you can read, you can relate to. That's what the Torah is. So they saw the voice. It's not just that they heard the voice. They saw the sound came out in a concrete form that they could actually see it. But in terms of our understanding and discussion this evening of the audio and the visual, we're being told something even further here. And that is that it's all very well, you need the audio and you need the visual. When the Torah was given, it was given with both. There has to be the scientific accuracy of the visual, the clarity of the visual. But there also has to be the depth, the understanding, the subjective involvement of the audio. But the nation saw the audio. Even the audio has to be perceived with the clarity of vision. And the danger with audio is that your imagination can run wild. You can do anything with audio. The example I always give is the noises you hear at night. You hear noises on the roof, you hear noises outside, and all of a sudden your house is being attacked by burglars. You've got it all worked out already. Where they come from, what they're doing, where they're going to come in, what you should do, and everything's being worked out already. Well, nice, it's a bit of contraction of the steel beams, or it's a cat on the roof, or a mouse outside. It's nothing very serious. But that's when the audio is left alone. You can make literally a mountain out of a molehill. You can make what you want. You can do anything when you're working with the audio alone. Because there's no objective test. You can't go out and have a look. You don't know. You can't see. So all you've got is the sound, and the sounds could mean millions of different things. So you use your own subjective interpretation to make it mean whatever you want. And that is the danger of mysticism. That you've got something which is so subjective, something which is so audio. It's deep, true, it's mystical. It involves the person, it's spiritual. But it lacks clarity. It lacks objectivity. And you never know whether you're right or wrong. When it comes to halacha, when it comes to the area of Jewish law, you can't go very far wrong. Because it's like mathematics, Lahavdil. You work down and you go and you go and you go, and if you've made a mistake somewhere, it's like a maze. You can walk to a certain point, but you come to the end and you realize you were wrong. So you've got to go all the way back and start again. So you come out right, you try again, it's wrong again, you try a third time, eventually you get it right. But it's very difficult to misunderstand. Very difficult. In fact, one will find, I said earlier, if 100 people come to a shir, you'll have 100 different versions as to what was said. That's much less so in a halacha shir. The person, if you ask people who've been to a gemara shir, you'll have people say, I didn't understand what was said. Or I understood part of it. But you won't find the same degree of diversity of interpretation as to what was said. At the end of the day, it all has to make sense. It all has to add up, and the bottom line has to be right. Not so when it comes even to a shir such as this, Motzei Shabbos shir. It's difficult because you're not dealing with things that can be that accurately pinpointed. There is a tendency to allow for an obscurity, to allow for a vagueness which you can't have in the area of Jewish law. And the chiddush of Matan Torah was v'chol ha'om royim es hakolos. That even when the audio was being used, even when the spiritual, mystical part of Torah was being communicated, it was being communicated with visual perception. It was being communicated with accuracy. It was being communicated with absolute clarity. There's no reason for it to be obscure and unclear because it's mystical. I want to take this concept one step further. We talk about the visual being objective, and in a sense it is objective. But yet we're told, this is a medrash in that same perik in Iyud, in perik Lamed Ches, Amr Rabbi Elazar, Oyer Sheboro HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'Yom Rishon, Adam Tzofe U'Mabit Misofe Olam V'Ad Sofo. The light that Hashem created on the first day was so clear, was so perfect and pure, that one could see with it both ahead in time and in space. There was no limits to how far one could perceive things with that light. Kivan Shemistakel B'Deir HaMabul V'Deir HaFlog V'Ror Ma'aseh Mekulkolim. When he looked at the generation of the flood and the Tower of Babel, and he saw how degenerate their actions were, Omad uGenozo mehem, he hid it away from them. Ulami genozo, and for whom did he hide it? La tzadikim le'osid lovoi, for the tzadikim in times to come. So we have here a concept that initially light was created as an objective reality available for all, but it was changed after the first day of creation when Hashem made it now available to tzaddikim only, which means that the degree of clarity now depends on the character of the individual. Clarity is no longer something objective, and that's something that we do understand. One understands it firstly, it's on the most superficial and simple of levels. It's easy to understand when you are confused. Do you see clearly? Now, I'm not even talking about seeing mentally and intellectually. I'm talking about pure vision. When you yourself are confused, you're down, you're miserable, look outside. You don't see things. Things aren't clearly defined. When you know where you're going and you're clear and you're on top of things, you look outside and everything's clear. That's subjective. And it goes, of course, when we talk about vision, not only as a visual thing, but when we talk about visual as understanding, as perception, as analysis, then certainly it is so. But the more one is able to be clear within oneself, the more one is pure within oneself, the more one is able to see. And so we see that even the visual, the ability to see accurately, is something which depends on the subjective level of the person who's seeing. Not everybody sees the same things. In fact, when it comes to subtle things, there needs to be internal purity to perceive with objective purity. And so we have to be certain that when one applies the visual power to the understanding of Torah, the two things have to take place. Number one, there has to be scientific clarity in the understanding of the Torah. Things have to make sense. There's nothing in the Torah which doesn't make sense. There's nothing in the Torah which is irrational. There are things in the Torah which we cannot fully comprehend. There are things in the Torah which we do not fully comprehend, but there's nothing irrational. There's nothing that doesn't make sense. There's nothing that's absurd. And there has to be inculcated in the individual who is studying the Torah character, refinement and nobility of such a degree that he is capable of that perception, that he is capable of that clarity of vision. So an objective and a subjective process need to be taking place simultaneously. There needs to be objective clarity in the material being taught, and there needs to be the concentration on the development of subjective purity in the character of the student, of the person who's studying Torah. Those two things need to take place simultaneously. And those are the areas of the fears of using the mystical in its canned form, in its intense form, on its own, to reintroduce the spirituality and to reintroduce the interest and the value system back into a routine and rather humdrum lifestyle. The danger is one's dealing with something that one might not be able to see with clarity. One's dealing with something which is very difficult to define. One's dealing with something which can easily be misleading, which can be misunderstood, and something which can lead one onto a vision of Torah and of Yiddishkeit which is in fact far off the mark. That was what the Vilna Gaon was so worried about. It was one of the things he was so worried about. Not that the intention of the Baal Shem Tov was that there was anything wrong with that. Not that the need was not a valid need, that it was so. But he realized that the moment you separate the Kabbalistic side, the moment you separate the mystical side, and you teach that on its own, without requiring of the person that he first has the tools to see things clearly in Torah, that he has the internal tools and the objective tools, to be able to analyze properly, to be able to see a thing through correctly, to be able to reason out to the end. If one exposes him to the mystical without providing him with the necessary tools first, there is the danger of not being able to be roye es hakulis. You will hear sounds, but you won't see them. And if a person comes to you and says, you know, I had a wonderful night last night. You say, what was so wonderful? You say, the adrenaline, it was so exciting last night. What was so exciting? You can't believe what happened, you'll tell you. I was lying in bed and we were surrounded by this mob of people. They tried to break into the house. They were first on this side of the house, then they were on that side of the house. They walked around. And you know what I did? I knew that I didn't have a chance against this mob. There must have been 50, 60 of them, armed with pangas and spears. And they were silent, but I could hear them walking around. I knew that there was no point in calling the police. I knew there was no point in taking them on myself. So I got dressed, and I did negavasa, and I went out of my room, and I went into my study, and I stood and I was mispalel before the Ribbono Shel Olam until the morning. And in the morning I came out, and they had scattered. No sign of them. Not even a footprint. And you say, you know, nice story, but I happened to be walking outside your house at that time. A few cats were wandering around in the garden. That's all it was. So what has happened here? He's had a mystical experience. His prayers were answered. He had this dramatic experience. He was exposed. It was dangerous. It was exciting. And he's on a high the next morning. But it's a hot air balloon. There's nothing there. It's illusionary. It's like being on drugs. He's had a mystical experience. Is that a mystical experience? Is that mysticism? That's illusion. That's hallucination. That's the danger of mysticism. You're using the audio without the visual. And you don't know what you see. You don't know what you're hearing. You don't know how you're interpreting. You have no tools. You can't see. So whatever you're hearing, the waters of the river Ganges are brown, or they're murky, or they're not murky, you don't know. There's no way you can judge. You have no basis for it altogether. That's what the Vilna Gaon is worried about. But at the end of the day, the question is not Torah, law, or mysticism. If you view the question that way, you're missing the point already, because if Torah is only law, it's going to be dry and you're going to need the mysticism. If Torah is only mysticism, you're going to hallucinate. Torah is law with spirituality. That in every law one has to discover the spiritual. But you study it through the right sources. You find the spiritual through the Shulchan Aruch. You find the spiritual through the Rambam. You find the spiritual through the Gemaras. You find the spiritual by going back into the Psukim and learning the Chumash with the Rashi, with the Ramban. That's where you find the spiritual. You don't have to can it. You don't have to extract it and then put it back in artificially. Torah is law and spirituality, not law or spirituality. That's where one has to find it. To be able to synthesize that which is spiritual with that which is scientific and clear. And that's something that we need to do with our lives altogether. Not try and find our kicks and our routines in separate areas. But to be able to synthesize them a little bit. To be able to find thrills in the day-to-day things we do. To be able to find human values in the day-to-day things we do. To communicate people with people, to share with people, to talk to people, to find spiritual values in our day-to-day lives. And then we won't find it so necessary to resort to all sorts of crazy things in order to introduce interest in our lives. We'll have the interest on a day-to-day basis. That's where it has to be done. And so in our learning, and so in our practice of Yiddishkeit, there has to be more spirituality in our davening. There has to be more spirituality in our tefillin. There has to be more spirituality in our learning of Torah, in our keeping of kashrus, in our keeping of Shabbos. Not to wreck it all. The famous Ramban at the beginning of Kedoshim, where he speaks about various aspects, and one of them he says is that Shabbos is not just not doing the 39 melachas. That's easy. Not doing the 39 melachas, but what do you do? That's not spiritual. So you've done nothing wrong the whole of Shabbos. You've sat in your room and you haven't done a single melacha. Fine. But there's still such a thing of tishbos, of making a Shabbos, of infusing a certain spirituality into the day, doing certain positive things to give it a value. It's not sufficient to strip it of the negative. There has to be an insertion of the positive. And that's the whole of our Torah. It's not just not putting a foot wrong and doing the right things that we can tick off one by one, go down the checklist, we've done it all right. That's not what Torah is. There has to be that too. That is the framework. But inside it all there has to be spirituality. Inside it all there has to be meaning. Inside it all there has to be understanding. And there's no shortcut in artificial canned products. It has to be found within the routines, within the regular things. That's where we have to find that meaning. Torah is not a question of law or mysticism, of law or spirituality. Torah is a system where our spirituality is found within our laws, and our legal system is found within the spiritual code.